Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Patrick Capiello, wine director, partner at Rebel and Renegade Wine Dinner in New York City. We'll talk about, well, basically everything wine with Patrick. We'll taste something old and something new for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben-Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Patrick Capiello is the multi-award-winning wine director partner at Rebel and the Renegade Wine Dinner in New York City. He's chef sommelier for the La Pauli Burgundy Festival, food and wine host for Playboy magazine, and creator of 40-ounce wines. So that's the proper intro. Now I'm going to do the alternative intro. Okay?
I can't wait.
Patrick Capiello, also known on Mulberry Street as Patty Caps, is the tattoo-clad, saber-rattling, metal t-shirt-loving, video game-playing wine guru at Rebel on the Bowery in New York City, where he's the partner and wine director and founder of the Renegade Wine Dinner. When he's not hanging out with the bunnies, he's the food and wine host for Playboy magazine and also chef sommelier for the wine orgy that we know as La Pauli. Patrick is also the creator of highly addictive 40-ounce wines. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. I've been looking forward to this.
Me too. I'm sorry it's taken me so long. You've been
chasing
me. Very persistent, and I appreciate it. This is one of my favorite places to be,
Patrick,
just because I get to crush pizza and drink beer while I'm working, I guess.
God bless Patrick. Patrick is a big supporter of Heritage Radio Network and has been on a lot of shows.
I have.
All right, Patrick, we want to assume that my listeners, some know about you, some don't. So I want you to quickly tell us about your journey in life and wine that got you to the point where you're at now, is Rebel.
Yeah, totally.
So work me up to that.
Well, I mean, I've been in the restaurant business since I was very, very young. Pardon me, I'm super hoarse today.
Rangers.
I'd like to say it's because I'm sick, and
Patrick was at the Ranger game.
We're not supposed to talk about that. I'm opening a restaurant in Philadelphia. I'm going to be fucked because all the Flyers
fans are going to kill me. Patrick was at the Ranger game, and both of us are going tomorrow night.
I'm goddamn right. Let's go Rangers. All right. Sorry. I started in the restaurant business when I was 15, and I've done literally everything there is to do, from washing dishes to bussing tables.
Tell people where you grew up.
I grew up in Rochester, New York.
America's most beautiful city.
It's a pretty amazing place. I grew up in a very loving household, lower middle class, household that had no interest in wine. My parents gave no shits about wine and never had it on the table, so I had no exposure to it. After many years in the restaurant business, I moved to Cleveland, Ohio, and I worked at a restaurant called the Baricelli Inn. A guy named Paulie Manillo owned this great restaurant. It was probably the finest, like the most fine dining restaurant in Cleveland, Ohio. It's gone now, but great restaurant. And Paul was super passionate about wine and had a great cellar. And he provided his cellar to guests of the restaurant. The wine list was basically his personal cellar. And it was a great list.
And
I have a copy of it.
Good.
Great food too. Yeah, I know. He's a great chef. So I didn't really know anything about it or really care about it. But I noticed that the waiters that were working next to me, and it wasn't a pooled house. This is back in the day. I mean, I'm old, so there actually was a time
not
when pooled
old.
House
I'm
didn't
old.
Exist. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I noticed that the waiters that were there that were selling these expensive bottles of wine were walking home with way more money than me. And I was like, you know what? There's got to be, there's probably something in this. Like, what the, maybe I should learn about this wine stuff so that I can make more money. So it was 100% attention. Greed that drove me into the wine business. But after I started learning about it, and the first book I had was Kevin Zrelli's Windows on the World. It was a super inspirational book. And the more I learned, the more I read, the more I tasted, the more excited I became. And so then I
How long were you at that restaurant?
I was there for about a year, and then I moved to New York. And Paulie,
you know what's funny? People say, why would you go to Cleveland? And I guess the answer is because I live in Rochester. It's like a step up, right?
Actually, my ex-wife was doing her master's degree.
She was.
That's why I went to Cleveland.
Okay. there you go.
So Paul Manillo recommended Tribeca Grill as being a restaurant to go to because he was friends with the chef. He's like, they have a great wine program. And that's when I started at Tribeca Grill. 2001, August of 01, I started at Tribeca Grill. David Gordon was the wine director.
You didn't go into the wine program.
I was a waiter who spent a fuck ton of wine in the cellar. I was like, I'm interested. I want to learn. This is a blossoming program. When I started, it was like 800 bottles on the list. And by the time I left, they had won the Grand Award from Wine Spectator. I was the first sommelier that they had on the floor there, working with Yoshi Takamura, who was one of my best friends, who was a great sommelier and worked with me at Veritas as well. So yeah, then that happened. 4 years at Tribeca Grill. Tim Kopeck came knocking and asked me if I wanted to take a position at Veritas. And in 2004, 2005, was not a bad time to be there. So
quickly tell people what Veritas was. It was a terrific restaurant, great chef. Was it Scott Bryan?
Scott Bryan was the chef when I was there.
But the wine program was off the charts because? Epic.
Yeah, because there was two collectors, Steve Verlin, who God rest his soul, and Park B. Smith, who were huge, passionate collectors who basically opened their personal cellars up to the restaurant for sale. So this wine list was unreal. Old vintages of Burgundy and Bordeaux and, you know, crazy amounts of champagne and all this interesting wine that you couldn't get anywhere. And they were really letting it go for, like, no money at all.
Right.
Which was super inspirational. So that was a pretty amazing 4 years. I tasted more great wine in those 4 years, and I've said this probably more times than I care to, but I definitely tasted more great wine in that 4 years than I probably will ever taste in my career. It was unreal.
Like, so as good as lucky. Tribeca Grill was.
Tribeca
and
was
that
great.
List evolved.
Amazing.
The Veritas list was like top of the game,
especially
right?
At that time. Yeah. At that time. So then after I left Veritas in 2009.
But wait, slip something in.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we'll talk about it at some point. There's the Burgundy Festival, La Paulie. La Paulie. You started.
Well, Daniel Jonas, whose event it is, he created La Paulie. When I was working at Tribeca Grill, he started it the year before 2000. He started it. And I used to work it for him. I used to be one of the somms. And over the course of time, David Gordon was the chef sommelier there solo. He was the guy running the sommelier team. So at some point in the last 5 or so years, David started to have an interest to kind of scaling back his workload. So they brought me on board as one of the somms that help run the show. So I'm super lucky to have two guys that I love and look up to allow me to help run something. In the end, unfortunately, they're making me manage 110 sommeliers, which is like herding.
And how many years have been at that?
Room of cats. It's 5 or 6 years now. I've been doing that with David. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And Riso Zazowski, who's the other chef somm there. So
from
yeah.
The Marea Group.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. So then that Veritas, I left. Sorry, I'm rushing it. I'm trying to get us.
No,
on
no,
the
you're doing a good
stuff.
Job. Very admirable. You may get the award for the best and fastest biography.
Oh, Levy Dalton once told me, "You always tell the same fucking story. Can you please say something different for once?" So I'm trying to follow his advice. then I took a job as the wine director of Gilt Restaurant, which is a 2-Michelin-star restaurant in the New York Palace Hotel that Paul Lieberman was the opening chef for. Jason Ferris, who was the head sommelier there before me, or the wine director there before me, started a really great wine list. It was like probably an 800-bottle list I walked into, and they had an interest in acquiring a Grand Award from Wine Spectator, so they gave me kind of an open checkbook. I mean, the Sultan of Brunei owned the place, so what the fuck? Like, and it was 2009. No one was buying wine. I remember being in, Restaurant Danielle during, like, Zaki's auctions and, like, being, like, one of four people that were actually bidding on wine. And I was just, like, taking stuff for so cheap. I remember, yeah, like it was pretty amazing time. It was a scary time for wine, but... So I built that wine list up to over 3,000 selections. Jesus. We won the Grand Award when I was there. And then that restaurant, unfortunately, closed. And
why did it close?
It closed because the hotel was purchased by a Midwestern finance company that didn't see the value of a two Michelin star restaurant and a wine cellar worth $2 million that never made any money.
Wasn't Cereal Macchione in there before
he
you
was,
guys?
Yeah, that was where Le Cirque 2000 was there. It was a weird time for them.
Kind of an interesting space.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's crazy. But it's a hotel that's run by a union, and you know, labor costs being what they are with the union service staff was challenging. And
did
we could
you
never
see
try
that coming?
Well, it was always union when I walked in.
No,
it.
But did you see the fact that it was going to
close? Yeah, when these guys bought it. I mean, I saw when they walked in. These guys said, you know what I mean? They weren't wearing the same shoes as the guys from the Dorchester group. Like, these guys were wearing, like, floor shines, and the guys in the Dorchester group were wearing, like, Louis Vuitton.
Right.
It's a little different, so their appreciation for whatever was, and then, like, not my style. I don't give a shit about any of that. Like, all that fancy stuff is not me, but it was where I worked, and yeah, I saw the writing on the wall real quick. We knew we were in trouble. But we ended it gracefully. I think we ended it well. They actually hired me to stay back on as the wine director of the hotel, which would have been an awesome opportunity and really an honor to do. But
you
while
didn't
I was,
take the job.
Well, I was sitting on my couch, you know, playing video games and getting up to whatever I could do to pass the time. and a friend of mine contacted me about a restaurant he was opening on the Bowery. Richard Quo was the opening chef for Pearl and Ash, and said, "Hey, man, we're opening this restaurant. I know you're kind of on hiatus. Do you want to come and maybe help us out?" And so I said, "Yeah, sure. It's something fun to do." So I was started as the consulting, you know, sommelier for Pearl and Ash, and then after 6 months, my business partner Brandon McCrill basically approached me and said, "Listen, you should stay here and be a partner." And I'm like, "Fuck you, dude. I'm going back to my cushy job up Midtown." And after
you,
all,
you were hesitant.
I didn't want to do it. Yeah, because I knew people who own restaurants, and I know that that's not it's like
you
a
weren't ready.
Stressful thing. Plus, I had this like opportunity to have, you know, this unlimited budget, and although it was appealing to me, like I loved the idea. I was I don't know. I just never imagined that I could pull that off. You know, you'd think. Like, the idea of being a restaurant owner sounds like such a big fucking deal. It's really, you know, once you get into it, it's fun and amazing, but it was super intimidating. So, honestly, I was scared. But
you got to get out of your comfort
zone.
Yeah,
100%. And Brandon convinced me to take a chance on it, and we went full blast of Pearl and Ash, and we started really ramping the wine list up. And again, same thing. We got the Grand Award from Wine Spectator, and shortly after that, we opened Rebel.
All right, so we're going to, a little later, we're going to talk about Pearl and Ash, Rebel. We're going to talk about all that stuff.
Cool.
But I want to talk to you about a bunch of other things in between. But a couple things. When you look back about, you know, what you did, two things kind of jump out. One is you increased the crap out of the wine list.
Yeah.
And you delivered a Wine Spectator Grand Award.
Right.
Veritas had one, right?
Tribeca Grill
and Guild.
Guilds, yeah.
And you started with a certain amount of bottles and left with way more, right?
We opened with a 200-bottle wine list at Pearl and Ash the week we opened. Levy Dalton wrote a really nice article in Eater, which really, I think, sparked the interest of the industry. And the industry came out in full force. People were so supportive. I mean, if you read the New York Times review
of Pearl and Ash?
Pearl and Ash.
Pete Wells.
Yeah, he references the fact, first of all, that Mike D was there one night, which he was, and then he references the fact that Michelle.
Good hipness factor.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing to have. And, and Mike has become a friend of mine and is super into wine.
He's a wine guy, right?
Super into wine. And a cool, cool guy. Like, really great. Like, Noble Rot. He just did an interview with Noble Rot magazine and, like gave me a mention in Pearl and Ash and Rebel. I'm like,
nice.
My friend Pax Molly wrote me. He's like, "Did you see that Mike D talked about you in Noble Rot?" I was like, it's like,
nice.
Head scratching shit. But so Pete Wells talked about the fact that like Michelle Cuvreau and all these other sommeliers were hanging out there. And it's what it was. It was like one every night was another you know, group of somms and group of wine people and winemakers and chefs. And the industry drove that
restaurant.
There
weren't a ton of places to go. So you wanted to create a spot that stayed open late.
Well, you know, when I first moved to New York, I was interested in wine, but like back in 2001, there were only a few wine destination restaurants, and you could go to none of them unless you had a suit to tie on.
Right.
And you look at me, I mean, I've always been the same interest in being casual. I wore a suit while I had to work, but I died for the idea of having a place where you could be that was casual. And then Paul Greco started Terroir, and that definitely started the movement. And I look at him as an inspiration. Like, Paul definitely laid the foundation that helped us create it. But there wasn't a lot of restaurants that you go to and have a meal and spend a lot of time and look at a wine list and get excited and see a lot of great value. And Tribeca Grill and Veritas had all that stuff.
Right.
But it wasn't, like, geared for young people. It was still something that was, like, adult.
It was more mainstream still.
Or just, like, a little more tense. Although Tribeca Grill is pretty laid back now that I think about it.
It's always been laid back.
Totally.
Yeah.
But so that was the inspiration, to try and create something that would be fun, that, you know, 20-something-year-old kids with tattoos and piercings could have a great bottle of natural wine, but businessmen who just finished...
Downtown feel that's open for everybody.
Exactly.
All right, let me ask you a few things.
Sure.
So I'm going to start with a general question, and I think you're more than qualified to answer this.
Okay. I'm nervous already.
And we talked about this before. Tell me about what the state... What is the state of and how you see the restaurant business now in general and how it pertains to you, your ventures, and wine? I mean, I think you've seen a lot of changes personally and in the market, and you alluded to some of that now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the whole country and the whole world is facing the fact that consumers of food and wine are different now, right? Millennials have a different way of approaching things. And I've always connected with millennials. I'm a Gen Xer, but I've always felt connected to the millennial generation because I think that they question authority in a way that maybe my generation didn't. And I like that. I'm inspired by it. All of my sommeliers are from that generation and I admire it. So that's great. But at the same time,
the market is being dominated
100%
millennials,
100%,
and they're inquisitive, like you said, right, and active,
but they also don't necessarily want to be conventional. They don't want to necessarily follow the idea of, well, this is the way my parents ate, so I should eat the same way. They're kind of like, fuck that. I don't want to eat that way. I want to eat how I want to eat. And you know, they're changing the game in some ways and in not great ways from somebody, you know, who runs a restaurant.
Give me one of the not great ways.
I mean, look at the way that they consume. The way they consume everything is different, right? They don't own televisions, first of all, which is fucking insane to me.
Landline phones.
No, nothing. But they also don't. They don't. It's the way that they don't go to the movies, right? It's crazy, and they don't really go to restaurants.
TV.
Exactly,
right.
And they don't really go to restaurants. They want to go. They want to stop in a restaurant and eat something, and then they want to go to a bar and have a drink, and then they want to have a bite to eat later. They want to keep moving. Their attention span is of a certain point, and them sitting down in a restaurant and having a 2.5 hour meal over several bottles of wine, like you and I like to do, not really in their view. Also, they're from a different economic thing. I mean, there's a lot more of them. They're fighting for jobs. A lot of them still live in the parents' fucking basements. Of course. So right. That's hard, and I get
they're
that.
They're not balling with bottles of 100%, wine.
And they don't want to. They'd rather rent their apartment while they go to Spain for a month, right, and Airbnb it. I don't want any strangers sleeping in my fucking bed. I'm not Airbnb in my apartment ever. That's insanity. But like, millennials have no problems doing that. That's weird shit to me. But I understand it.
I want
to understand how we work on that. So, you know, Rebecca, we've done a lot of things. We started doing delivery. You know, we were open as an all-day cafe. You have an opportunity to roll in there with a laptop and have a cup of coffee. Melissa Weller, who's doing our pastries, you can have a little snack. Daniel Eddy, who's the chef, will make a steak sandwich for you. We're trying to understand it. And then in the evenings, it's the same thing, like having a bar menu that's a little more casual. It's not like they're asking for hamburgers and french fries like you and I were. They're asking for different stuff. They appreciate great products.
Healthy.
And healthy is 100% part of it. Yeah.
But kind of cool and rustic.
Yes. I would say that they're like things like roast
plates,
chicken, and like it's stuff that you and I would eat that our mom would make, but maybe they didn't have the opportunity to have those kind of home cooked meals. So they don't know how to cook themselves, which I really think is what it probably is. Most millennials probably are not awesome home cooks because they live in tiny apartments or they're always on the run. Or
I agree.
Yeah. So anyway, that's a rant right there. I need a drink.
So the pivot the pivot was to the millennials because they're an important segment of your market.
100%.
So you adopt to that.
Everybody's doing it, man. You have to adopt to it. Yeah, you have to look at the fact that they're controlling things now and either get on board or get out of their way, I think is the way you got to look at it.
All right, so let's ask the same question about sommeliers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I asked you, you know, what's the state and how do you see the restaurant business? How do you see sommeliers in general? And how does it pertain to what you're doing, you know, in wine?
Right.
What's going on with sommeliers, let's say, today versus
when you
got in the business?
Again, I think that they're a product of their generation. You know, I have sommeliers that are amazingly dedicated people. Kimberly Precocian, who you've interviewed, amazing.
She's great.
Really great. Bryn Burkhan, who left us to go work with Stephen Bitteroff from Von Boden, amazing. Caitlin Couric, Caitlin's going to kill me for fucking her name. Caitlin is going to be the head somm for our restaurant that we're opening in Philadelphia. Also an amazing hard worker. So plenty of great examples of millennials, and their staff that works under them are also amazing, supportive, and great. But I'm lucky to have this roster of people who work hard, and we've had plenty of people who started in the wine program and then gave up. And that's difficult to see, but I think that it's an example of the fact that sommeliers nowadays want a shortcut to what they see as what a sommelier is or what success is. And I think that's a true for millennials as a generation. They're looking for a shorter way to get there because.
So the route you took, had to take.
I worked
because for
years.
You to get to your own restaurant or let's say to get to Gilt, mm-hmm. it wouldn't be how you would describe a millennial today.
I worked for 8 years as a cellar rat and a floor somm before I bought one single bottle of wine at Veritas Strawberry Girl. Great places, admittedly, to work, but I never bought a bottle of wine until I was 36 years old. No one does that.
Right.
No one does that.
So millennials have changed the game as far as 100%.
But I think it's for good and bad. I think that they've encouraged, because there's such interest in it and a passion for it, that restaurateurs see that there's access to sommeliers and that people that actually want to buy and sell wine to their guests. So they'd be like, wow, I should have a sommelier. But in some ways, I think restaurants that probably should not have a sommelier have brought that on. And then since they have, two things have happened. They've changed the role of what a sommelier is. There's a lot more sommelier roles now that involve a lot more management, a lot more hours, a lot more duality. Like they're having to do a ton of other things as opposed to concentrating on the wine list, which I think burns them out. And then I think also the fact that there are restaurants that probably can't really afford a wine program that would warrant a sommelier. If you have a 50-bottle wine list, just have a
train
manager.
Your waiters.
Exactly. You don't need a sommelier on the floor. Yeah. That guy's going to be bored and leave.
Yeah.
So I think that as a result, there's been a lot more sommeliers that have become unemployed. And now we have, you know what I mean? It's like actors, right? I mean, there's a lot of unemployed actors in this city. And I think that there's right now a lot of unemployed somms in the city. But it's not because there aren't jobs for them. I think that they just want to be like Raj Parr. They look at Raj and they're like, Raj busted his ass. Man, that guy came here as an immigrant and worked his ass off to be where he is. He didn't get to be Raj Parr overnight. He worked very hard to get where he is. And that's not the job.
No.
Raj Parr is like the retired version of a sommelier and an amazing version of it. But that's not actually the job.
You know, I think of two people. I had Kevin Zraley on last year. And he said when he started in the business, there were maybe 5 restaurants with sommeliers.
Completely.
He goes, now you go into a restaurant and there's 5 sommeliers. Mm-hmm. You know, so
it's true.
That has changed. And a good friend of mine who was on, Gary Vaynerchuk, is all about patience and paying your dues.
Totally.
And it doesn't sound like the sommeliers today, you know, want to put the chops in, you know, to get where they want to be.
Yeah.
All right. So a good segue to that, because of millennials, is social media. I want to talk to you about social media because I think it's important to you and to your places.
Sure.
Let's first talk about how social media has changed the wine game and how you, you know, embrace it.
Sure. I think, you know, I mean, I've talked about this before with other people, but I mean, I always pay up to Mike Madrigal and Raj Parr for two guys that really taught me about it. Because I'm a pretty introverted person across the board, even though I seem like I'm not. I don't, you know, I have the same 5 friends.
Like this dude is wild.
I mean, I have a lot of fun with my friends. I'm not going to lie. Those guys will tell you I'm not an introverted person, but I'm not overly trying to make new friends.
Right.
I've never been on Facebook. I've never been on MySpace. I don't know what any of that shit is. When Raj Parr came to me at Gilt, he's like, dude, how does nobody know about this great wine program you have? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I did it. They should have. It's here. It's like you still, have to tell people.
It was a teeny bit young then, and it shows you how ahead of it Raj was.
100%.
Because then it was borderline. Now if you don't do it, it's like, what's your problem?
Yeah. He basically signed me up for Twitter that night, and I was like, Jesus, all right. And then, you know, Instagram came around. I got on Instagram because I like taking photos. So my friends, who are mainly artists and designers, all were like, oh, we're on this thing. You should check it out. I was like, oh, this is awesome. You can take pictures and like show them with your friends. That's the kind of thing I'm going to do. I don't need to worry about like, you know, ex-girlfriends from high school coming back after me or whatever it is that everybody's afraid of to go
Facebook,
on Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't
Same
want that.
Here.
I don't
no
want
interest.
That. I had nobody was nice to me in high school.
But you have
those
a
people.
Rebel
I don't,
Facebook
I don't want
page.
Those people.
Yeah, I'm
yeah, I don't,
totally
I don't,
with
I,
you.
I don't want anybody from high school who didn't give a shit about me to contact
that's
me on the internet.
That's why to this
so
day,
fuck
right.
those people.
I'm right with you.
So that's why I'm not on it. But there's a rebel. I guess there's a rebel Facebook. I don't know. Or, who somebody controls that, but
there
it's
is.
Definitely not me.
There is.
But so that the Instagram became interesting to me. So really Instagram, I embraced, I've been on it since like it started. Like you can look back at my feed. I think somebody made me look at some point. I don't know what the first year was that I was on it, but it's a long time. But it wasn't back in the day pictures of wine. And then slowly but surely I started realizing, oh, if I take a picture of a bottle of wine, people seem to be responding. And then all of a sudden some guy comes up to me and says, oh, I follow you on Instagram. And I'm like, that's super fucking weird that you're telling me that, bro. But I'm like, okay, cool. Welcome to the restaurant.
And sort then of I, what it is. You 100%. Don't think about it.
Yeah.
But guys are checking in every day.
You yeah. know,
what's Patrick doing?
That's an honor.
You're an influencer.
That's super cool. And I'm, I hope that I'm doing it justice. And I hope that people continue to want to support the restaurants because of it. And yeah, I'll do it. I mean, if I remember one time I took a picture of my nephew and niece in front of a Waffle House. And I think I got like three people like acknowledged it. And I'm like, you know what? Okay. So people don't give a fuck about my personal life. Great. I'll never take a picture of anything having to do with my personal life again.
So that's how social media works for you. Personally, I mean,
yeah.
that's how you've embraced it.
It gives me an opportunity.
You're not gaga about promoting yourself, promoting.
You I mean, know, it's your promoting venue. Yourself, of course.
No, you about are, it is, but it's but not. You know, you do it at your pleasure type thing.
I try to be responsible with it, and I appreciate the power of right. it, and I'm psyched that it exists.
So let's talk about how social media has changed, you know, sort of the wine game. And I could tell you that, you know, to sort of stimulate this conversation, you know, when you and I were a little younger and nerdy in wine, there were two, three guys that were voices.
Yeah.
You know, Parker or Berghain, whoever it was, mm-hmm. Wine Spectator.
Yeah.
Now, social media, the internet, has opened it up, you know, to the point where there's a million voices. I mean, do you see, like Raj Parr has a voice.
Huge
you
one.
Have a voice.
Yeah.
Do you see that?
Totally. I think it's, you know, I think in some ways the playing field has kind of been evened by it. I think, you know, if you're a journalist or a critic, you have a different, you know, you have a different level of power, right? When you're a sommelier, you only have an influence over the people that are in your dining room.
Right.
Traditionally.
Right.
When you're a critic or a journalist, you have access to all these people that are following what you're doing in a periodical or in a newsletter or in a magazine. And that's a huge different set of and it's the same thing in some
but
ways the same
social
way as the dining
media
room well it,
give that to the sommelier
well I think that it just gave everybody whether
a
you're a sommelier or a journalist or a critic the same kind of access to people
right
and people that were it's a captive audience uh-huh. and an audience that's you know excited about finding out information and I don't think it's not there to harm or help any one of us. I think in the end, it's better for the people who want to buy wine and know about it.
Right. There's way more voices.
Way
and
more.
People that are
and
qualified
people can select and choose.
Right.
If they're like, I don't like this asshole because he drinks too much natural wine, or I don't like this
right.
guy because he drinks too much fancy, you know, old French wine, then you can make your decision and you can say, I don't want to hear his voice. And you just shut him off.
I find a lot of discovery on it.
Yeah.
You know, I could see things that you're doing and what you're drinking. You know, when you're
Completely.
Traveling, obviously, if you're traveling, you're stopping at certain wineries. Those are important to you.
Yeah.
Or you're anxious to see them. You know, that's an influencer thing. And everybody, you know, has that.
Right.
So there's a huge amount of discovery. So we see social media as a positive.
I think so. I mean, for me, it's been a huge help for my business. And I know that other people that are involved in it are as excited as I am. So,
yeah,
I think it's good.
And I think it's going to continue to be that
I
way.
Don't think it's going anywhere.
No. Let's drop a little, while I have you here, let's drop a little wine knowledge
okay.
on our listeners, all right? So let me blast through a few questions.
All right.
Let's talk about what are some wines we should be drinking now? And the context is seasonal. You know, so you don't have to say rosé.
Yeah.
And also what's sort of hot now. You know, what should people be eyeing? This is all your opinion and direction.
I mean, I'm still very psyched on what's happening with the new young generation of American, not California, not new California, a new American winemakers. And, you know, looking at
like a Chris Matheson.
Amazing
and the
kid.
Lakes.
Awesome right. example. Like Bellwether, right. I think, is awesome. And I know Chris really well. And I think he makes fucking great wine.
I had him on. And
yeah.
he was terrific.
I mean, you know, I think that there are and obviously what's happened. There's producers in Oregon that are doing the same thing.
Like a Walter Scott or something.
Well, White Rose, I think, is great. Bodecker, I think, is great. I mean, I think there are young producers that are focusing on more classic kind of winemaking techniques. and really making wines that deliver from rural areas.
So, Bellwether, Chris Matheson, give me the Washington guys. Give me the specifics. Who'd you mention?
In Oregon? Oregon, you said. White Rose is great. And
White Rose, that's the winery?
Yeah, Bodecker is another one that's really great. And then in California, I mean, you got people like Michael Cruz, who is just like fucking slaying it. Scott Schultz from Jolie Lade is great. And then you have the guys that kind of were leading that charge, like Steve Mathiason and Pax Malle, Roger
Parr. They're like old-timers at this point.
Yeah, I mean, those guys started the movement, I think, that inspired the rest of the world. And, you know, and then you have, even people like, for me, looking at somebody like Maynard James Keenan, who's a friend, and I'm a fan of his music.
Keenan is the lead singer of Tool.
Tool. And Pussifer and A Perfect Circle.
Right. And he is Arizona-based?
He makes wine in Arizona.
And he started his own wine and wine, he's truly dedicated. I know you were out there not
out
that long ago, right?
Mind. Yeah, he's out of his mind. Yeah, I am.
He's an intense dude.
And amazing. But if you see what he's doing out there, it's pretty, pretty spectacular.
And the wines are great.
I've tasted the wines from the inception. When he was making it with grapes blended from Paso Robles, they started off very good. But, I mean, they started off good. I shouldn't say that.
Right.
I don't think he's listening.
Well, thank God he got better.
But if he is listening, go fuck yourself, man. But they're great now, and he's really trying to change the way that he's making wine in a way, because now he's really making the wines. He had a guy that was making the wines that turned out to be not such a great dude and kind of screwed him over a little bit, and I think that he didn't have the freedom to express himself the way that he does now, but now he's really on. He's making – the guy makes the wine. He doesn't tour in the fall because he wants to make wine.
So I guess the takeaway is – you don't even have to look outside of the country. There's some exciting wines and winemakers all over the U.S. outside of, you know, what people perceive as just the Napa-Sonoma area.
100%.
Which is a nice thing. All right, while we're on that, let's talk about natural wine. Since I've been doing this show, the natural wine movement has been in place, but I've heard a million different voices on this. The Raw Wine Fair came out to Brooklyn last fall. It was cool to have that. They had a great, you know, showing. I think you're an advocate of natural wines. You carry all the mainstream and natural. Just tell me your take on natural, organic, biodynamic, you know, wines. Are they good? Why are they good? Why are they important?
I discovered like natural wine. I always do like my finger quotes when I say that shit, because who even knows what that means. I discovered those wines through a very good friend of mine who was a mentor, a guy named Joe Doherty, who has sadly passed away, and he was a guy who was super into the wines, but he used to come to Veritas all the time and was happy to drink Rumier, or not just Rumier, not even fancy stuff, like regular, like just normal, like great Burgundian producers, like Moulin Rougeborg back before it was Moulin Rougeborg. But he also would be interested in these wines that we didn't have on the wine list at Veritas, and he would bring bottles in from time to time for me to taste, and I grew interested in them, primarily from the Loire Valley.
Loire.
And when I started at the hotel, he would come there and really kind of help me add a lot of that stuff
to
the wine list.
So he was a true influencer and enlightened you.
Huge mentor to me. And
not much noise outside of him interacting with you and all.
Well, I didn't really have many people to look to, because I really wasn't part of that cool kids kind of crew who were drinking those natural wines back then, because they didn't come to Veritas. You know what I mean? I remember coming to probably was like Marlow and Sons or someplace that I went to back in the day. And I remember being with a bunch of friends, and I was like this fancy wine guy who worked at this in the New York Palace Hotel or Veritas. And they were like, oh, the wine guy is going to choose the wine. Give him the wine list. And I remember looking at the wine list. I'm like, I don't know. I didn't recognize one single fucking name on the wine list. And now that's probably half the wines on my wine list at Pearl and Ash, or at Rebel, whatever, any of the places. But, you know, it was a weird time, because it wasn't something that was in my life. And most sommeliers have the reverse experience, where they start off drinking this cool, geeky stuff, and then eventually they get the chance to taste all this really regal stuff.
So tell people what the attraction is. Obviously, if you weren't attracted, you wouldn't move towards
for
it.
For sure.
What, you know?
Well, I wasn't going home, you know, on a sommelier's cellar and drinking first growth Bordeaux or, you know, Grand Cru Burgundy, because you can't do that. You know what I mean?
Tasted
so I had
enough,
to drink
though.
Something. And
right.
So then I kind of fell in love with Beaujolais first. And then I discovered the Loire Valley, and there was some great stuff in there that really turned me on. And those are hotbeds for natural wine.
Those guys naturally do natural wine.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
Totally. So that really kind of spawned the interest. And then when I had the ability to start buying it, which was at the hotel, I was buying like crazy and tasting all these natural wines. No one, I mean, they're still there. No one was buying those wines. Who the hell was going to go to a 2-Michelin-star restaurant and drink a bottle of La Pierre Beaujolais like for, you know, $39, whatever it was at the time?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
How would you describe, is there a difference or is there a description of organic, biodynamic, natural wines versus, you know, well-made Burgundies, Bordeaux's? I mean, what's the appeal? What's there?
Well, I mean, there's a crossover there. I mean, all those terms you use, there's crossover, right? There's biodynamic producers who make wine in Burgundy. For example, Domaine de la Romanée Conti is a biodynamically farmed domain.
They follow the Rudolf Steiner.
100%.
The ram's horn in the dirt.
Leroy is another one that does the same. So Chateau Latour is biodynamically certified. Does anybody know that? No, because they don't put the label all over and they don't talk about it and they don't go to raw wine fairs ever. Right.
So, they kind of don't have to.
Well, no. I mean, but still, at the same time, so there's crossover there. And there's plenty of conventionally farmed shit that claims that they're natural wine. So I don't think you can... And there's hard because you can say you can trust certifications and all that stuff. I think you have to, in the end, you have to taste wine because there are plenty of wines that are made with no chemicals in the vineyard and no sulfur in the wine and non-interventional winemaking that taste like shit.
They suck.
And you see people fawning over them.
That's winemaking like anything else. Some guy makes a good wine, some guy makes a bad wine. Doesn't matter what the process is.
But I think people are more, and I think young inexperienced wine drinkers who want to feel cool and say, oh, I drink natural wines, become accustomed to these unhealthy natural wine flavor profiles that aren't good. Like, overwhelming amount of volatile acidity, mousiness, like yeasty kind of like reductive qualities aren't necessarily, they're not healthy made wines.
No.
So I think that to take on those things and say, to forgive them and say, oh, not just to forgive them, but to say, that's great. This wine's so fucked up. This is great. Let's all talk about how great it is. I think it's gone. The pendulum has swung so far to the other way where it's like a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah.
Very dangerous. And I see it even with my sommeliers. There are times where I taste wine with them. I'm like, let's look at this for a second.
Right.
Or let's leave the bottle open for a day and let's check back on it and see where it's at. I try to be a voice of reason in some way. I'm not saying I know everything or I'm the person that
you
should
try to mediate it or balance it or whatever.
Let's think realistic about it.
Yeah.
Just because it doesn't have sulfur in it doesn't mean it's good.
But do you think a good biodynamic or organic wine, is there a purity and an energy to that wine that doesn't exist in a similar wine, or that's not fair to say?
I've had plenty of examples of domains that have make wine with that are experimenting with it, that are looking at it and struggling with it and realizing that they need to do it. And a lot of them have been converted. A good example is Roeder, right? A very famous
sparkling wine house.
Like amazing, right?
Right.
And you know, the winemaker there is super passionate about biodynamics and has been trying to convert the estate over. But obviously he's dealing with probably a board of rich guys who are controlling him, and he has gone through the process of transitioning some of the vineyards into biodynamics, and he'll walk you through the vineyards and you'll see the difference. Like, that vineyard was farming with chemicals, that vineyard is farming biodynamic. Wow. And you can see, which is obviously the better one. And then he'll take you into the cellar and he'll be like, this wine was made from grapes that are all farmed biodynamically and this is from conventionally farmed, and you can see a difference. And not just see a difference, there is a, as you said, a more energetic, intense thing that's with those wines that are being farmed in this way, in a biodynamic way, that it makes it taste more exciting.
So done well, it does possess those traits.
I think
traits.
So. Again, cool. Within balance. Cool. Or within reason. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about what you're doing now. And what you're doing now is, we talked a little about Pearl and Ash, which was your first restaurant.
Yep.
Closed down, not for bad reasons, just you're moving it.
We closed it. Yeah, I think that the landlord who's my partner. We had a great lease when we started, and you know the neighborhood has changed. And you know he's a businessman; he has to conduct his business. So I think that you know at some point he was excited for us to look at getting fair market value for the space. But with the concept that we had, I don't think we could afford to do it in that space.
So you're going to carry on and move it to another space.
So we're moving it to a new space.
So stay tuned for.
We're looking in the West Village. Yeah, we're looking.
Are you looking at 2017, 18?
I think since we have another project and possibly even another one happening before that, I think we're going to wait until after this year.
Okay.
Because I think it's probably better anyway. Let's give some people some time to miss it.
And let's jump into Philly. We're opening a restaurant.
Yeah, it's called, we just announced the name today. Actually, philly.com announced the name. It's called the Walnut Street Cafe. It's in
How'd
a building.
How'd you get that name?
Really, really crazy. Took a team of people to come up with that one. Well, it's on Walnut Street, if you must know.
Oh, okay.
So Walnut Street is a very famous street in Philadelphia.
Know it well.
And it's a street that probably, it was known for, as Restaurant Row for a long time. Now it's Retail Row. All the restaurants have been scared away. Lebec Finn was probably the most famous in there.
George Perrier.
One of my very good friends, Justin Bogle, opened a restaurant in that space called The Vec, which sadly has closed since. But I know the history of Philly. I've spent a lot of time there. Not at Flyers games, obviously.
Yeah. Fuck the Flyers.
Only because I'm afraid for my life. So we understood the heritage of Walnut Street. The building that we're in is on the corner of Walnut and 30th, and right over the river from Center City in West Philly.
Sure.
So we thought, you know what? Let's pay homage to this street that really kind of was the game changer for the city and a place where it was a culinary mecca. So it seemed fitting to call it the Walnut Street Cafe. So we're opening in June.
Oh, so it's mid-June, imminent.
Mid to late June. Yeah,
so we're almost Philly there. People, keep your eyes out.
Yeah,
and open
fun
wine list.
Chef
Street
Daniel
Cafe.
Eddie, our chef from Rebel, will be the chef there.
He will.
Brandon McCrill is my business partner. Cool. Is also the director of operations. Yes.
So let's talk about Rebel, which is your current day job.
Yeah.
And Daniel Eddie.
Yeah.
Is the chef at Rebel.
Correct.
And Daniel is a Michelin one-star chef.
One Michelin star chef. He worked at Spring Restaurant in Paris for many years under Daniel Rose. Super talented, awesome, fun,
So really you have a restaurant wine program where both sides are kind of off the charts. You have an amazing menu. And let's talk about your wine list. You have a very extensive wine list.
It's pretty huge.
And I think one of the things that you learned and carried through the years is you're not the guy who kills and marks up wines. You talk to me about, why you do that, what it is.
I think it's obviously when it comes to running restaurants, especially in a city like New York, there are a lot of things that you have to pay. You have to pay for your rent. You have to pay for your utilities. You have to pay for your staff, which every year now is getting more and more expensive. I mean, minimum wage in the city.
It's going up.
It's nearly impossible to be a small business owner in this city, and I'm not going to start jumping into politics at this point. But I will say as a small business owner, as much as I want my staff to be able to succeed and live in a very expensive city, it's hard. Because I don't have that extra money just laying around. So in the end, it's gonna trickle down to our guests. And most restaurants would respond by raising prices. For us, our goal has always been to make the money based on volume. So I look at it like if we keep a low markup on the wine list, you're going to drink more bottles, which in the end is going to mean the same
and
amount
have
of money.
The best offering.
Right. And it's going to be
the correlation works.
Yeah. I mean, in the end,
you sell more wine and the volume protects you.
Very rarely do people walk out of Rebel sober. I'll say that much.
Right.
And, they're kind of compelled to keep drinking.
So let's talk about the wine list quickly. It's obviously a mixture of mainstream, terrific wines, Bordeaux, Burgundy. We talked a little about natural wines. They're there. What's the predominant slant of the list? By country or by type of wine?
Yeah, I mean, it's U.S. and French.
Is the predominant core to it.
Yeah, and I think we try to strike a balance between classic and new wave is what I would call it, as opposed to
Give
natural
me an
wine.
Example. Classic example of classic and a classic example of new.
I mean, we have a vertical of Chateau Margaux. We have a vertical of DRC. We have a vertical of Rumier.
So that's your classic.
We have a vertical of Lafarge. Doesn't have to be expensive.
Have Michael Cruz wines.
Yeah, and Michael Cruz, or I have
Aquamarine or whatever.
Ultramarine. Yeah,
Ultramarine.
Yeah,
right.
Verticals of Bernard Baudry from Chinon. Verticals of Gone on from San Josef or Terry Alemán, plenty of great producers, in the old world, as well as a ton of wines in the Jura. We have verticals of Domaine de la Tournelle, a producer that I love that makes wine in the Jura. Domaine de la Tournelle. Yeah.
Tournelle.
Yeah. Correct. Okay. That's correct. Yeah.
Good
it's a
wine
small,
to look for.
Small husband and wife winemaking team in Orbois. Yeah.
All right. And you do some cool stuff there and stuff that I know, and I've actually attended things you do, and you'll describe them to me. You do a winemaker series.
We do.
And you've created and you're famous for your Renegade Wine Dinner. Let's talk quickly about each of those.
So the Rebel Winemaker series came, wine dinners are something that kind of came up in my life. Working in the Palais, working at Tribeca Grill, we always did a ton of wine dinners. So when we opened Pearl and Ash, I was like, I want to do wine dinners here. Seems like a crazy idea. We had this little communal table that fit 12 people perfectly. I'm like, 12 people is the perfect amount of people to have at a wine dinner because it's 2 ounces of wine. So we can do a lot of different wines. So we came up with this idea for the Renegade Wine Dinner. which we started. Well, we just announced our 100th Running Game Winder, which there are tickets available for. So if anyone out there
and that's
is interested,
your that's Patrick number two.
Patrick picks number two. Yeah.
And you know, if you trust Patrick from what you hear or what you know, and you're into wine, the list is off the charts.
Yeah, you can make reservations at rebelnyc.com.
If you want to sample some, you know, knockout wine.
And there's a website that has all the wines. It's renegadewinedinner.com, which All the dinners are listed. We show every dinner that we've done for the past 100 dinners. So that started at Pearl and Ash. And then once we opened Rebel, we decided we wanted to take a different slant on it and actually have the winemakers there. Because the Renegade dinners, if you've been, they're very un... They're not... They're educational in whatever way that you as the guest want to have it.
Renegade is more theme driven?
Yeah, but it's also it's
winemaker. You know, you have a winemaker, and you know, it's
less educational, I would say.
Okay,
like it's more about experiential. The Renegade dinner, it's about what you make it. Like right. You get to taste all these great wines, but there's nobody giving a speech about the wines or talking at you. It's about having fun, drinking and eating, and you know, communing with people that are at the table. At the winemaker series, we have the winemaker there, which I think if you're going to have anybody talk about the wine, why the fuck do you want me to talk about the wine? Who cares what I think? Have the guy who made them talk about the wine.
And
that's really what matters.
You curate who you bring in. So, I mean, you've got interesting guys coming in.
For sure. We try to bring people in that we know our guests will be excited about it. Right. Not, you know, I'm not going to say that there are producers that we wouldn't work with, but there are definitely producers that we know are more interesting to our guests. So we try to follow their lead.
So if you go on the website is
RebelWinemakerSeries.com or RenegadeWineDinner.com.
Right. And if you look at past events, you'll see the depth and the kind of diversity of, you know, what's going on there. And it's paired with amazing food. Patrick, we're talking to Patrick Capiello from Rebel. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about 40 ounce, a project of yours. I'm going to subject you to our wine list. And then we're going to taste a couple of wines on the air, of which one of them is a 40 ounce. So you're listening to the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Patrick Capiello, proprietor and partner at Rebel on the Bowery in New York City. I'm going to subject Patrick now to our wine list. I'm going to shoot him a bunch of questions and see what his take is. Don't overthink these.
I promise.
Give me some quick answers. All right.
I don't know how fast I can think anymore.
All right. So first question is, what are you drinking now? Not right here, but what, you know, is it seasonal? Are you trying things? Are you stuck on a region?
You know, I mean, I find myself really stuck in the Northern Rhone right now, and I have been probably I've always loved it, but in the past...
You're staying with it.
I mean, I've been stuck there just because I'm kind of compelled as to what's happening.
But are you leaning towards Cornas, or are you leaning towards St. Joseph?
You know,
I mean, are you...
I think probably it's more about winemaking techniques in the Northern Rhone that's become really compelling to me. Like whole cluster Syrah, and maybe that's just the genre as opposed to saying just the Northern Rhone. I would say whole cluster Syrah is turning me on now.
Tell people what whole cluster is.
So it's when they harvest the grapes, they don't actually destem the grapes. So a lot of
And you don't destem the grapes, so you don't let the juice come out, right?
Right. You just throw all the grapes in, you do right. some foot pressing, and then you let it. Some producers will let it ferment a
Give
little
me,
carbonically.
An example or two of some good Northern
all
Rhone
whole cluster. Like Dardan Ribo is one that Spell. I really like a lot. D-A-R-D and R-I-B-O.
Okay.
Pierre Gonon. G-O-N-O-N. Which is Jean Gonon, who's making the wine there. And then in the New World, somebody like Pax Malle, who makes at Wind Gap, right. and then Pax Wines, all whole cluster. Raj Parr has a Syrah that he just started working, that he's working with whole cluster.
Right.
White Rose, the one we mentioned earlier, is also is a whole cluster Pinot Noir. So, yeah.
Good
I think
ones.
Whole cluster is something I'm excited about right now.
Give me your favorite wine and food pairing. If you say champagne and oysters, I'm throwing you.
I would never say that.
Champagne
I would say Cabernet Franc and pork shoulder. I like that pairing a lot. I mean, because you know Cabernet Franc has great tannin, which helps cut through that kind of fattiness of the pork. But also, there's that earthiness that both of those things have. And it's
give me a couple of good Cabernet Francs. What's the region that good ones come from, and give me a producer.
Yeah, I would say, you know, staying in areas like Chinon is one place that I think is great. And
Baudry.
We mentioned Bernard Baudry. Ogre Raffaut is super old school. If you want to go someplace that's kind of off the radar in Turon, which is like Central Loire, Turon, T-O-U-R-I-N.
Right.
Turon, there's a producer called Garlier that's Spell. There. That's a, oh, God damn, I don't know if I can spell Garlier.
Give it your best
G-A-R-I-L-L-I-E-R-E. Garlier.
All right. I won't make you spell anymore.
That's going to be a big problem for me.
Besides Rebel, and you're out and about a lot.
Uh-huh.
Your favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And I want you to answer that where the slant towards the wine, the service, the selection is important.
I would say Company, the
Caleb.
Caleb's wine. Going and then 10 Bells, I've been going to forever. Like, and Sev is great. She's a really awesome sommelier and super passionate. And, you know, it's fun. She always turns me on to something new there when I'm
cool.
there. So, and they're also in the neighborhood. So.
I'll tell Pasqualine you left her at.
you said wine bar. She's a restaurant.
Okay. I said wine restaurant.
You said,
and
I think you
bar.
Said wine
no,
bar.
It's right oh, there, the well, question. If I'm overprepared.
If you're going to tell
worry.
Me restaurant, I would say
you're
restaurant.
Right. There's no wrong answer. And I didn't ask you that to sort of corner you.
Sounded
you know,
like you just
mean?
Did. I'll be honest
I did.
With you.
All right. Give me your favorite all-time wine. Was it a birth wine? Was it
my,
the first?
My epiphany wine? My epiphany wine? I can tell you what that is in 3 seconds.
Chateau
it was,
Margaux.
It was Clos Vougeot from Leroy 1990. Not that it was something I was drinking a lot. Yoshi Takamura gave me a taste when I worked at Tribeca Grill.
And so that's a Burgundy?
It changed my mind. Yeah, it's a Grand Cru Burgundy from a producer who was partners at DRC forever, a woman who's...
And what was it about it?
I never had old Burgundy. It was the first time, so it just I was like, wow, like this is something that's I don't know, it just I can't say what it was about it, but
it was all put together.
It changed my mind. It changed right. my life 100%.
So that was the Clos Vougeot.
Clos Vougeot from Leroy.
Leroy.
Yeah, 1990.
All right, help me with this. I got my son Ben sitting here. He's going to a dinner.
Uh-huh.
With 6-8 people, he's got to bring 3 bottles of wine. I need you to recommend the best wine around $15, give or take. I need a red. I need a
it's
white.
A tough
you got to go
man.
Retail.
It's tough because there's not much wine left at that price point anymore. Honestly,
what do you know? I'll give you the white. I mean, a Muscadet.
It will always be the answer. Muscadet. It's the last great region for $15. Beaujolais, you can barely talk about that anymore
for $15.
Yeah, I would say you know you can go to the Mâconnais, like Côte Chalonnaise. I think in the Languedoc, there's a lot of good value there to be found. I think we can talk about places like Chile that there's some interesting stuff happening there. But right. I think it's hard because those are big, broad brush strokes to say about regions, and there's a lot of shitty wine made in all those places.
Right.
So to say that it's that easy to walk in a wine store, I think if you're looking for a $15 bottle of wine, it's going to be great. I think find a merchant that is smart and knows how to buy wine right, that you trust,
tell
and then
what
trust
you like.
That person to help you find something. Make it buyer specific. Discovery Wines in my neighborhood is an awesome example. That wine store is great, and they know how to deliver great value. And Trevor, who's the wine buyer there, is a smart fucking guy. So I would probably more rely on people who would work in that venue.
So I've asked this question for about a half a year. You know, best wine around $15.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you validated And you're not wrong. I mean, $15 is kind of a tough.
You got to make that $20 now.
Is it? So that's my question, and I would defer to you.
I don't want to drink a $15 bottle of wine. It's probably going to give me a fucking headache.
Is 20 the good low?
I think
if you go lower, yeah, now you're fishing.
Have a couple of mezcal shots before you have the bottle of wine. So drink it slower. I mean, you don't always have to get drunk on wine. I think, you know, wine should be something you have with a meal. Right. Start with a cocktail.
Right.
Finish with a bunch of beers. Have a nice bottle of wine in the middle.
All right, let's finish the wine list with tell me your favorite band and your favorite all-time album.
My favorite band and my favorite all-time album. That's a very tough question to answer. I would
give me a couple answers.
Well, I mean, David Bowie is by far my favorite artist, and I would say Hunky Dory is probably one of my favorite albums. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Bowie.
Yeah. Another album. I mean, Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream is probably, you know, an epic album for me as a kid. That was in the 90s, really. Nevermind by Nirvana, Pearl Jam 10, if I want to date myself. But as far as, like, what albums that I love.
Guy wears a Metallica shirt every other day and doesn't say Metallica. That's okay.
I love Metallica, but that's a layup. That's easy.
I know, but I think you hit it on those. Those are all classic albums. And they're important.
I'm also a vinyl lover, so that makes it easy.
Yeah. They're important to you because they came through when you were coming through.
Yeah, my brothers taught me a lot about music, and Bowie was one that my oldest brother loved. So
you can never go wrong with Bowie.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to talk about 40 Ounce, but we're going to kind of wrap it into our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we're going to taste two wines. Normally we taste one, but I want to taste Patrick's wine. We're going to taste the old, which is a 2003 Rocchioli estate-grown Chardonnay, and we're going to taste a 40-ounce, which is the brand name. What'd you bring in, the Muscadet or the Rosé?
I brought the Muscadet.
Okay, a 40-ounce French Muscadet made by Patrick and...
It's not made by me.
Is Julian still making it?
Julian Brode is the winemaker. Okay, I just was the person who conceptualized it. Yeah.
Your project, though.
Yeah.
The Rocchioli is probably only available by auction. You probably could pick it up for $40, $50, $60. And the 40-ounce is available at good wine stores, better wine stores. And it's retailing for $15 up and down.
Yeah. $13 to $16, depending on the store, I would say.
All right, so... Can you tell me a little more? Let's just give me a quick thing about the Rocchioli. So we're drinking a 14-year-old Rocchioli.
Totally.
From my cellar, Good Provenance. Is it holding up?
Yeah, totally. It's great. And 03 was a warm vintage internationally. In California, it was no different than it was in France. Or not no different, but it was a warm vintage. So, but I think it's great. I mean, color is great. It looked...
So it's a golden yellow.
Yeah, for sure. And... Nose. Aromatically, it smells. It has kind of those ripe pear kind of aromatics that you get with Chardonnay, but it has, you know, some flintiness underneath there too, which I think is, like, you know, more commonly associated with Burgundy. I mean,
let's throw it over the tongue.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, it's great. Good acid,
huge,
good minerality,
feel.
And
medium
that's
to
good
full
length.
Bodied.
Yeah,
still
yeah,
still feel the acid.
Really great and good,
holding
great
up
length.
Nice,
like
huh?
you can still taste it a few seconds after sipping. Yeah, very good. I wouldn't have imagined this wine would be this fresh.
Me neither.
Yeah.
It is pretty fresh for,
you
know,
hope you get a few more bottles in yourself.
It's a good winemaker, and the provenance was good. Let's talk about the mouthfeel.
Yeah. I would say it has, like, you know, it's textural, and it has a little bit of viscosity. It hangs there. And, you know, there's like kind of a zestiness to it. But, yes, there's also kind of a opulence to it. It holds in there. Yeah, really good. Really good. I wonder what the alcohol level is on that. Because it holds it well. Back then, the alcohol levels were higher. Yeah, 14%.
Is this a typical big Cali Chard? Is it?
I would say it's a good example of wines from that era and from that region. And I had a chance to taste a lot of those. So I would say that this is what you would find with Marcuson and Martinelli and Paul Meyer and other producers
good
of that
producers.
of that decade.
I'm happy to see that it's holding.
Yeah, up. Congratulations.
All right, we're going to save the best for last now. Ben, will you open up the and we're not comparing the two.
No, it's not.
You know,
it's apples
so
and oranges, but yeah.
Let's talk about the project now.
Okay.
The wine is called 40 Ounce.
That's the
name
of it.
They make a rosé. We're drinking the Muscadet.
We make a rosé and a Muscadet. The Muscadet was the first wine that came out last spring. It was 2015 vintage of Muscadet. It's made by a young guy named Julian Brode, who is, I think, kind of the next generation of great winemakers in the Appalachian. He worked with people like Marc Olivier from Pepier. And then I'm going to go back to the Rocchioli.
Okay.
I'll drink it from.
Here's a cup.
Okay. So,
so Olivier, Pepier, those are great Muscadet producers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, what he was able to do with what Julian learned from those guys was the idea of making wines that have intensity and power, but also finesse and, you know, true to the terroir that they're grown in. So he works with all organic and biodynamic farming. This vineyard is transforming from organic to biodynamic currently. These are 30-year-old vines. The grape that they grow in Muscadet is called Melon de Bourgogne, and it's a common pairing with oysters, actually, now you mention
it. Like, well, Muscadet is a great oyster. It's great. Seafood.
So I was visiting the winery with my partner, Chris Deser, who we conceptualized the wine together with. And this bottle, which looks a lot like a 40-ounce, if you grew up...
A 40-ounce malt.
Yeah, it looks just like the same bottle.
It's a screw top.
Yep.
It's sort of that soda 40,
yeah.
You know, ounce malt.
It's bottle. Actually a liter bottle.
It looks cheap, but it's not.
Right. Well, and that was the idea, was when we saw it on the shelf, we were like, shit, what is that bottle? And he said, well, we bottle grape juice in it and sell it at the market. And we said, well, would you bottle wine in it? And he's like...
So you saw it at Julian's?
We saw it at Julian's winery in the cellar.
That they bottled grape juice. To...
Right. So we asked him if he would be interested in bottling wine in it, and he said, I guess, but why? Because they don't have ounces in France, right?
Right.
So it's a metric system.
Right.
So it didn't translate to him at all. And after we explained to him the reasoning and the idea behind it, and the idea behind it has always been, like, Chris and I have always been had an idea of using alternative packaging to make wine more friendly, more approachable, take away the pretense. And something like this does that. It's a cultural reference, but at the same time, it's also it's bringing down the pretense, and it's a wine that has a great value. So we looked at this as being an opportunity to do that. I came home from France after talking to Julian. I said, let me see what I can come up with.
When was this? A couple of years ago?
This was 2015. And I came back and met with a designer friend of mine and gave her the concept, Carolyn Frisch, who I think is a great designer and did a great job with this label. I talked a lot about inspirational kind of images, like 40 ounces of Old English and Mickey's Big Mouth, the ones that I drank as a kid. I mean, I grew up
Mickey.
In skateboard culture in upstate New York, and right. I drank a lot of 40s as a kid through
get
high school and college.
Quick.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cheap way to get a buzz.
Yeah.
So we kind of conceptualized this idea of trying to package this like this, make it affordable, make it approachable, make it fun. And
make it quality.
And make it great. And you know, healthy wine made organically and have it taste great, which was the most important thing. I mean, what do you think of it? You just tasted
it.
Well,
let's
– yeah.
I want you – because you're better at this. So the color is kind of a pale yellow, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the nose.
Yeah. I'm too busy drinking it. Sorry. I mean, aromatically, minerality is the first thing I get, right?
I
it has
get
kind
a lot
of that crushed oyster shell.
Which you get with Muscadet anyway.
100%. And there's a little bit of that fruitiness. I think you get some of that stone fruit in it, right?
Yes.
There's, yeah. I mean,
definitely stone fruit, wet yep. stone.
Yeah.
You know, a little of that. I mean, good characteristics.
Yeah. Thanks. And then
little,
you know,
wildflower.
Yeah. Floral. There's a floral aromatic as well.
Definitely. You know, not overpowering, but there. So it's got a great nose. All right. Let's throw it over to the tongue, boys. Terrific acidity. Right.
Yeah.
I would say right in the middle, medium mouthfeel.
Yeah.
Not light, not heavy.
Yep.
Medium, medium light. Good, though.
Mm-hmm.
Good first attack. Little pear.
Yeah.
Green apple.
Sure.
Good acidity.
I love that you're doing this. This is great.
Good acidity.
Yeah, good acidity, right? And it has length and, you know, and persistence.
You wouldn't expect.
A little bit of spiciness to it.
Yeah. What else do you get? You get a little spiciness.
Spice, for sure, I would
definitely
say.
Definitely the acidity.
Yeah, lingering acidity. Yeah, minerality, same thing. Has kind of a chalkiness to it, right?
Yes.
Kind of, it's like lip
the
smacking.
The stone and the chalk. It's,
yeah.
It has a nice little delicious factor for this kind of wine. You know, it's good on its own. It'll be great with food. So let's talk about what's a good food pairing with this.
As we said, oysters, I think, are great.
Seafood.
Yeah. I mean, and I think,
let's,
you know,
go out of the box. What else would this be good with?
You know, I would have like charcuterie, anything like if you like haven't before a meal, like pâté, or, I mean, if you look at areas where charcuterie tends to be
hold
dominant,
to
like
fat.
In Alsace. Yeah. I mean, right. High acid Rieslings are the things that you were pairing with charcuterie. So I think
right.
that this fits in that same sort of
okay.
area.
All right. So the wine is called 40 ounce.
Right.
40 OZ.
Mm-hmm. O-U-N-C. Yeah, no.
No. Actually, you know, it's funny because I wrestled with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's F-O-R-T-Y.
Yep.
O-U-N-C, 40
yeah.
ounce.
40ouncewines.com is the website. Yeah.
The Muscadet is, that's the website?
The flagship wine. No, 40 Ounce Wines is the website. Okay. Muscadet was the first wine we did, and then we just did the Rosé.
The Rosé.
Which became kind of a internet, like, overnight viral sensation.
I recommend it highly. I think Patrick...
Thank you. You and Khloe Kardashian, you know, she was drinking it the other day.
Oh, boy.
Somebody sent me a photo. Listen, that's fine. I'm happy to have her be a
spokesperson.
Things
are going great, and then you mush me right in the same category there.
You know what? There are worse people you can have promoting your wine than Khloe Kardashian. I don't necessarily want to spend any time with her, but I'm glad that she's drinking the wine.
All right, go back to the Rocchioli for a second. Mm-hmm. It's an older Chardonnay. It's held up well. It has, you know, age characteristics. What's a good pairing for that?
I mean, I think with this,
you got a baller bottle of wine.
Yeah.
It's, you know, good maker. It's older.
Yeah.
Special. What
for
do you
sure.
put there?
I think at that point you want to.
Patrick's parents are leaving.
No, that's not my parents.
Not. Go ahead.
I would say something like, you know, like a grilled fish would be great with this. Anything with butter is going to be good with
grill,
this. Lobster.
The grill gives it a little extra added. And the butter gives it some.
Like
it could cut
butter poached
that.
Lobster in this would be like, pff, I mean, you know, that's probably that and I'm ready for bed.
All right. We're going to wrap the show up. So we tasted the 2003 Rocchioli Estate Grown Chardonnay. Thank God the California Chardonnays with good provenance are holding up well. And we tasted a new wine, Patrick's 40 Ounce, which is currently available now and probably the perfect summer wine. I mean, you slam four or five of these in a cooler, head out to the beach. You didn't spend a lot of money, and the quality to value ratio is like a home run.
You're going
to
sleep well.
So keep a lookout for that. Patrick put his heart and his experience into that. All right. If you have a question, a wine happening, or an event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's Sam at the Grape Nation. Follow us on Facebook, and that's under the Grape Nation. We're going to post Patrick's wine list answers on our Facebook page. We'll give a mention to the 40 ounce. Follow us on Instagram at sbenruby and Twitter at benruby. And Patrick, where can people find you on social media?
Patrick Wine.
At Patrick Wine for Instagram.
And Twitter.
At Patrick Wine for Twitter.
And I'm not on Facebook, as we've already established.
Okay, which is fine. All right, I want to thank our guest, Patrick Cappiello, for coming in. We probably could have spent another hour or two with him, which means he has to come back at some point. So
happy
do you agree
back.
To that?
100%. Let's get David Gordon on the show once I do, though.
Patrick is listening. The wine director and partner at Rebel in New York City. That's downtown in the Bowery. He's opening Walnut Street Cafe in Philly in June. Keep an eye out for Pearl and Ash probably next year. I want to thank our engineer Vitor and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.